Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
When you're down one, trying to keep it at one so we have a chance. Also recognizing that if Miller and Cody pitched, that would have been 4 out of 5. Pretty high stress, high leverage innings. Decided to try to go a different route. Didn't work out as well as we wanted, but you're right. We do have those guys available with a day off behind it. We're trying to win the game. I mean, we talked to Kluber after every inning, and I thought he held his stuff real good. I thought his legs started to get a little bit tired.
I made a mistake to Donaldson, but other than that, I felt fine out there. I think that you get so much adrenaline in these games that, you know, if there was any extra fatigue or anything like that, I think it probably goes away pretty quickly. Try to win one more game. I mean, you know, we're one win away from the World Series. I think that's what we're focused on.
So that's a good lineup over there. They put the ball in play, and they're able to move some guys around, and they're able to put up runs. You know, they got, like I said, they got a good team, but you know, so do we. And our bullpen and our pitching normally does the job, and just didn't go our way today. We're in a great position. You know, we're still up, just going in tomorrow with the same mindset. You know, keep putting that work, and you know, just go out there. You know, like I said, have a little bit of fun. You know, let it hang out, and just do our business.
I'm gonna try to go out there, have fun, relax, pitch to my strengths, not let the game speed up on me. Trust in myself, trust in my defense. Let's go out there and compete, try to win a game for us. Right here, boiling down to the World Series, you know, it's a different feeling, you know. I'm just really excited to be able to have this opportunity and chance to help the Indians.
For me, when I first saw it, you know, it kind of angered me, you know, because to hit a guy blindside, if you're going head up with a man and you beat a man face to face and he sees you, you see him, all right, cool. But if you're a special teams guy and you're popping that stuff on there like, you know, you're some type of superhero or something, and you're just because you're hitting a guy blindsided and you think that's cool, that's where the problem comes in. So I think he should stay to his special teams and what he does, and don't, you know, post stuff when a man's not looking, you know, and taking a hit like that.
I understand where Jordan's coming from. I mean, that probably happens literally all the time, though. I've seen it happen before. You know, it's unfortunate. Like I said, we're just praying for, you know, Jordan makes a speedy recovery and Jordan's back in the locker room.
Certainly you'd hope that there was some sensitivity involved when, you know, a guy does go to the hospital because of a hit. I think that's one thing that I'd like to see the NFL do is not use highlights of plays that were penalties, like celebrating, you know. If you celebrate with the football, they like to use that as a way to market the game, but yet they fine and penalize players for it. Same thing with the big hits.
The only thing I didn't like was when the guy posted it bragging, you know, relentless. What is relentless about that? Hitting a guy, another man, when he's not looking. I love Poirier like a brother, and that really angered me. And we could go to the next question, but that was bullcrap.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Make no mistake about it, we are going to have a fight about that story a little bit later on this program, right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, where we are Toledo's sports leader. Thanks so much for being a part of the program today, but I got to tell you, I don't think we can really start the program today as the Indians out there in Cleveland, well, not technically out there in Cleveland, but up there in the Rogers Center in Toronto right now. We cannot start their second attempt at winning the American League pennant and heading to the World Series. Their second try, and it better be their last. You don't want to get into this. We cannot start their second attempt to get to the World Series in a clinching game without setting the tone.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you gotta be willing to take the hits. And not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
That's what I'm talking about on a Wednesday afternoon edition of an extravaganza that is leading up to a 4:08 first pitch, which is leading up to 9 innings of championship baseball, which is leading up to a World Series appearance for my childhood hometown favorite baseball team, the Cleveland Indians. Going to end the drought after 68 years of futility, but to do that, they got to get by this one. Are you taking note, Indians? Are you taking note, Ryan Merritt? I need to hear that again. I need to hear that louder than I just heard it. That wasn't loud enough. It's all right. But that is how winning is done. And it's not done the way that they tried to do it yesterday. I think we can all agree upon that. The offense simply not getting it done.
That's how winning is done.
Yeah, that's not how it was done yesterday. The offense not able to get it done against the Toronto Blue Jays, and now they've got, that's with Corey Kluber, their ace on the mound, and now they sent a guy with 11 innings of big league experience, 11 innings under his belt out there in a clinching game on the road up at Rogers Center against a newly motivated and newly excited and newly empowered Toronto Blue Jays lineup after they took Corey Kluber down on short rest yesterday. And it's on that note that we begin the extravaganza. What's going on, Mr. Cushman? How you feeling?
I'm still feeling pretty good, honestly. Despite the fact that last night went the way it is, and I know over the course of the next little bit we'll be talking about this, but I'm going to throw this out there right now.
What's that?
It's Ryan Merritt, one major league start under his belt, 11 total major league innings.
Yeah.
Let's just throw that very small sample size. This is more or less almost like one of those rookies start making their major league debut. And what seems to happen in those?
What do you mean, well, almost like it is a rookie making his major league debut?
Basically making his...
I mean, he's a rookie, and yeah, he's making his playoff debut with 11 innings under his belt. It's, yeah, this is first time ever.
Right, yeah. So I'm thinking of this one along the lines of what usually seems to happen these days, Bob, when a rookie is on the mound to start his first ever major league game. One of two things seems to happen, and they're very rarely, it seems anyway, is there any middle ground. Either he gets lit up like the 4th of July by the third inning, or he looks like Cy Young. I don't know what it is, but haven't you noticed that over time? So,
well, yeah,
that's
my first thing.
I think that we're looking at one of those two. We're not looking at he's going to get through five and give up two runs on five. No, he's either going to look like Cy Young today, or he's going to get lit up like the 4th of July.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I do see your point, and we have seen rookies making their debut suddenly, you know, have a great start, and people are like, wow, look at this guy. And then, of course, after, you know, a team sees him a couple times, it's like, okay,
right,
I know what he's got, and they adjust to it. I feel like since this is desperation mode for the Toronto Blue Jays because they are facing elimination literally each time out now,
yep,
I feel like it could go somewhere in between where he has two or three innings of superb performance because they don't know what he has yet, as long as he can settle his nerves, of course, because they don't know what he has yet. But I don't think it's going to take two or three or four starts the way it does oftentimes in rookies making their major league debuts in a regular season for people to get the book on him and then kind of light him up and then he has to adjust back, et cetera. I feel like it's going to take just one time or two through the rotation or through the batting order, I should say. So it's, to me, what I can see happening is here in Merritt getting out there, as long as he has it, you know, if he doesn't have his nerves settled from the beginning, then, you know, all bets are off. And that's something that Jose Bautista has made a big deal of. He has said, and he's just coming right out and saying, and he's putting it into Merritt's head. He's putting it into the media so that people are talking about it so that eventually it gets to him. And he has said that Merritt is going to be shaking in his boots. That's a direct quote from Jose Bautista. that Merritt is going to be shaking in his boots in Game 5 because of the Blue Jays' great lineup, because of the volume of the crowd there in the Rogers Center, and it's just going to be a lot to overcome. That's what Jose Bautista said. Now, if he's right about that, then all bets are off from the get-go. If Merritt is settled, he's got enough stuff to get through a time or two through the lineup. But once every hitter has seen him at least once or twice, probably twice, they're going to know what he's had. And the question is it time to go to the bullpen in the fourth or the fifth, after maybe the second time through the rotate or the lineup, depending on how things go? Is it time to go to the bullpen and put the, you know, best bullpen in the major leagues into play early on? Or do you kind of hold off? And that, of course, depends on the other side of the coin, which is the Indians' hitters. If they have a lead, I don't think Terry Francona will hesitate to go to Andrew Miller in the fifth again. I don't think he would hesitate to put Cody Allen on early like he did in game number three. I don't think he would hesitate to bring Otero. All of the things that he did in that bullpen game after Bauer was unable to go in game three, I think he would do again as long as they have a lead. But, Jim, the question is can they get a lead? Because as great as this has gone in building a 3-1 lead over the Blue Jays, it hasn't been because they're clubbing the Jays into submission. They won the first two games, scoring a combined, what, 4 runs?
2-0 and 2-1.
And then, of course, game number three, they it was 4-2.
Mm-hmm.
And then yesterday, just 1 run. So, I mean, what are they averaging? They're averaging around 2 runs a game, 2.1, 2.2, something like that, through the 4 games in the ALCS. So, to me, if they can scratch out a lead, even if it's a 1-run lead, but certainly it would be better with a 2-run lead, and if Merritt makes his way unscathed or relatively unscathed through the lineup twice, then I think it's immediately get to the pen, and I feel pretty good about that.
I completely agree. That would be the game plan. I almost would go so far as to say if Merritt can get you somehow into the fifth inning and the worst case is you're only down one or it's tied or the Indians are leading, he'll go out there for a fifth, and the first sign of trouble, i.e. first base runner, they'll go right to that pen. You know, tomorrow's an off day if there is a game six. Miller and Allen didn't pitch yesterday. So say it's 1-run lead for the Indians in the fifth. Oh, yeah, you better believe Miller and Allen both at least are going multiple innings in today.
Oh, yeah, no question.
No question.
You know, and they did that in the Boston series, too, yep. Where each of them threw 40 pitches, which I think I remembered was
that was the opener, I think, game one.
First team to have two relievers go 40 pitches
yep.
in a playoff win, and I want to say since 2008 or something stupid, about 8 years it's been. So, I mean, it's just not that common is the point in all of that. So the question will be, is Jose Bautista right? Is Ryan Merritt going to be able to handle the swings? And by swings, I mean the emotional swings that come with a walk. You get a base runner and watch the crowd up there in We the North go nuts. Will he be able to handle that? Will he be able to handle back-to-back-to-back Bautista and Donaldson and Encarnacion? Can he handle that kind of pressure? 11 innings in his major league career? 49,000 nutty Canadians screaming at him? Is he going to be able to handle that? Jose Bautista said he's going to be shaking in his boots, and I don't want to give any credence to that, but I have to say Jose Bautista probably has a point here. I don't care who you are. You're 24. 24. Now, the Jays had a 24-year-old starting game number 4. The Jays had a 24-year-old starting game number 3. The Jays have a bunch of young guys, but they've been pitching all year.
Right. Perfect example was yesterday. We kind of forget, although now looking back to hindsight 2020, Bob, yesterday's game makes sense. The Indians, in a way, only got a run on 2 hits total. After all, because he didn't have enough innings, Aaron Sanchez was actually the AL's league leader in ERA.
In ERA, right. So, I mean, you know, it's one thing to be young and have had a great year of experience and been pitching in some pressure situations. It's another thing to essentially make, as we pointed out, your major league debut.
Right.
Merritt was had a 3.70 ERA and 24 starts at AAA this year, 143 innings before he got the call-up, made 3 relief appearances, as we talked about yesterday, and the 1 start against Kansas City. He did hold them to 1 run on 3 hits and no walks in 5 innings. Of course, that was in the division has already been sewn up series. Yes, we are fighting for home field advantage, but this is not something that was going to cripple anybody if they lose today. And today wouldn't be crippling either. All today would do is make it 3-2, and they're coming back to Cleveland for games 6 and 7 if necessary. But it would put into a lot of people's minds, you know, what the Cavaliers just did in the NBA Finals, coming down from 3-1 and winning the world championship over a team that kind of figured they were on cruise control. It's okay if we lost game five. Even if we lose game six, we're coming back to our place for game seven. And we saw what happened to those Warriors in game seven. And don't think that that isn't on the mind of the Toronto Blue Jays, whose motto is, what the heck, let's go ahead and make history. And essentially, that's what they're saying up there in Toronto right now. Let's just go ahead and make history and come back from a 3-0 deficit to win the American League pennant and go to the World Series. So that's, you know, that's the one problem with the way this thing has kind of played itself out. And I don't want to sit here and play hindsight 2020 guy by saying the Indians shouldn't have started Corey Kluber on 3 days rest. I'm not saying that. I understood the desire to say, you know what? We just used up our bullpen or a great chunk of it in the bullpen day we had to have in game three because of the Bauer split finger thing. And I don't mean the pitch a split finger. And so let's, and we won, and let's just go ahead and bring Corey and end this thing now and get all the rest we need to get set for the World Series. I understood it all, but I questioned it. And I questioned it because it's very, very hard to sweep league championship series. And I just felt like the Blue Jays were due. Now, I felt like that for game three, too. So, I mean, and the Indians won. But I felt like the Blue Jays were due, and I kind of feel like if there was a time to send Ryan Merritt to the mound, it might have been yesterday. In that, if they are due and they're going to get their licks in, this is a good time to let him absorb those, almost be a sacrificial lamb. And then in game five on full rest, okay, you had your fun yesterday. Here comes the ace. Here comes the 2014 Cy Young Award winner. Here comes a guy who's going to finish in the top three or four in the Cy Young this year. Here comes Corey Kluber. That's what I would like to be saying about this afternoon. Now, I'm not the reason I say I'm not being hindsight guy is because I said that before yesterday as well. I tweeted it as a poll question on our Sports Radio 106.5 Twitter feed. So that people could kind of say, is this a mistake? Are they expecting too much of Kluber here on short rest? Should this be, you know, is this the wrong call? And so that's the one thing that I look at now that I'm nervous about today, because not that momentum means a whole lot in baseball, because momentum is often in baseball only as it can only take you as far as the next night's starting pitcher. You know, you get a lot of momentum in baseball, and the next night an ace comes out and just shuts you down for eight innings. Your momentum's gone. You're just done. That's just how it works. But I really don't like the idea of the Jays winning two in a row. That does give them just, it fills their balloon back up with air. It deflated like crap after they lost the first one at the Rogers Center to fall down 3-0. It's just like all of the wind was out of their sails, all of the air out of the balloon, just shoo. And if they win yesterday, they get, wow, look at that. And now they win again, and it's 3-2. And now the pressure is all on the Indians to not blow a 3-1 lead and make it an even 3-3 series with Josh Tomlin on the mound. And that, to me, is just... Well, I mean, it is what it is. It's dicey and it's risky, and they rolled the dice yesterday with Corey Kluber. Kluber did not pitch terribly, by the way.
I'd call it a B game for him, honestly.
He didn't get rocked on short rest. They didn't know. He had never done it before. There are some guys who have pitched on short rest multiple times in the playoffs, and you get an idea of how they can handle it, how their body, their arm, their joints, and everything else handles that. You know, Clayton Kershaw, for example. But Kluber had never done it. They had to find out if he could do it. And I agree with you, Jim. It's about a B effort by Corey Kluber there. But I got to tell you, I really would feel great about an A effort from a fully rested Corey Kluber going into tonight's game clincher had Merritt gone yesterday.
And I do get that principle. And, you know, as I'm thinking about it today, one of my thoughts is something that I kind of was thinking yesterday before, which is one of the reasons, let's not forget, why the switch was made is post-Bauer injury. And he was saying this, of course, during Game 3 and then right after Game 3 of how it would be Kluber. The thought process being, you know, for a team that so far these playoffs, by the way, has had the mantra of, I'll worry about tomorrow when we get there. This is the one time he decided to worry about tomorrow, because if it does go to a seventh game, which, of course, by definition means the Indians have a whole lot more problems than the following, at least it's Kluber even on 3 days rest in a seventh game and not a question mark bullpen day, yeah, like where you have to throw out a Ryan Merritt. That makes me feel a little bit better should it get to that point. So I still understand why he did it. And then, you know, after his outing, You know, he could have probably gone another inning or two on if he wasn't, in theory, coming back for a possible Game 7. That's part of the reason I think he was pulled after only the 89 pitches in five innings, thinking, well, I'm not going to bust you to 120 if we have to play a Game 7 in a few days.
Of course.
And then, you know, he does get a B game, so I'm still okay, you know, with that decision that was made. And a little bit more of yesterday was, it's more on the fact that Toronto still, you know, they don't have the injuries the Indians do. So they have their full complement of starters, and some of them, like Aaron Sanchez, the American League's ERA leader for 2016, are pretty darn good when they want to be.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And again, I'm not sitting here playing the, oh, my God, the Indians screwed it up and Terry Francona made a terrible decision here by going with Cool. I'm not saying that at all. And everything you just said is right in terms of the long-term planning here in a possible Game 7 scenario. I totally get it and I totally understand it. I'm just in the mode of, I'm worried about Merritt at 4:08 today in about a little over half an hour. I'm worried about him, and I would have been worried about him yesterday. I would rather have been worried about him at 3:00.
Yeah.
Than 3:01.
And
I'm saying.
No,
I everything you said makes sense. I can't dispute it. I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer here, especially if it does come down to a Game 7, God forbid. You do want to have Kluber available. So I get all of that. But to me, I don't think that would have been the case. I think if Merritt goes and doesn't get it done yesterday, I think it gets done tonight with a full rest, fully rested Corey Kluber.
And that
just would have been my belief.
And that very well could have happened. Of course, as we know, the reason these decisions are being made is Terry Francona's in a no-win, no-choice kind of situation, given where everything is. By the way, something has bothered me since that game went final yesterday, and it's this. And I'm glad you mentioned a few minutes ago the name Tomlin, because almost nobody did last night in a post-game scenario. The thought, all the talk seemed to be, well, if, you know, Ryan Merritt looks like a 24-year-old making, you know, who has 11 innings under their belt, they almost were saying that we're looking at Game 7. I'm actually a little mad. So, if I'm going to understand you national guys correctly, you're just assuming that Josh Tomlin is finally going to get rocked in a Game 6. Because that's what that's implying. Because it would be Tomlin in Cleveland who's had outstanding two starts in these playoffs and still has been a much better pitcher when that calendar flipped to September. So this isn't a new thing. That August is pretty far behind him, it feels like, at this point. But I love the vibe that I was getting nationally. Well, I don't love it. I didn't like it at all. Because the vibe was, Bob, it's almost like if they lose this game this afternoon, then it's almost guaranteed to have a Game 7. As if they're discounting that Tomlin. Yeah. They're just assuming he's going to get rocked in Game 6. And I see no evidence in his recent starts to suggest that.
I don't think people are assuming he's going to get rocked. I think they're just concerned because of the pressure of the moment. Again, Tomlin made his first postseason start too, you know, and did well, did very well. You just kind of get the sense that sooner or later, look, they're not playing the Minnesota Twins or the Atlanta Braves or one of the teams that had the worst record in baseball. They're playing, you know, the American League wild card winner and the team that swept the best, the team with the second best record in the American League. No, the best record. Take that back.
Yep.
The Rangers. This is a very good team and they're going to get theirs. You know, it's not just a matter of, and this is sometimes what we find ourselves being guilty of, not just us, me, you, people here listening to us, but sports fans in general. We oftentimes put it all on ourselves. It's like our guys didn't pitch well enough. Our guys didn't hit well enough. We didn't do this or that, as if the other team is just there to be our foil, just to be, it's up to us. Our destiny is ours. Sometimes we forget that the other guys have really, really good players too, and they're going to get theirs. Encarnacion didn't hit 37 home runs or whatever it was this year by accident. Donaldson, Bautista, these guys aren't what they are, by accident. They're tremendous hitters. That's a solid lineup. And the feeling is, okay, Kluber's got the best of them in Game 1. The Blue Jays got the best of Kluber's in Game 4. Tomlin got the best of them in Game 2. Will the Blue Jays, who are very, very good, take the measure of Tomlin in Game 6? And is it all going to – do you see what I'm saying? So they're not just assuming Tomlin's – I don't think anybody is bagging on him anymore for that horrific August he had. He gave up so many home runs in August, he ended up leading the league in home runs allowed, the majors in home runs allowed. I think people are just saying it's tough to beat the same team twice with the same pitchers and the same circumstances, and it would have been nice to end this thing early when you were given the opportunity. You don't want to go into a Game 6 counting on Tomlin to be able to replicate that performance, even though you hope he can,
yeah,
and you know he can, hoping he will and that he does, and that the Blue Jays continue to stay handcuffed. Remember, the other team is very good, too.
And by the way, speaking of Tomlin real quick, it's this is my one worry in terms of merit for today. If you want a very quick bullet point observation and scouting report on what can Merritt do, the way it was worded to me, that makes it make the most sense the quickest. He's a left-handed Josh Tomlin. In other words, he's going to throw a lot of junk, but it's going to be around the plate and nothing is hard. That could be a problem if some, you know, hangers get stuck up there for a Bautista or somebody.
Yeah, but you know what? He kept all of his breaking stuff down in that game too. He really did. And that's, I mean, he had them chasing. He had them swinging in the dirt oftentimes. I mean, it was a really, really solid performance. I'm talking about Tomlin now, not about Merritt. I'm talking about Tomlin. So now we go to Merritt here. If they follow the same blueprint, and that's exactly where Mickey Callaway comes in, the pitching coach, they have the book. While Merritt doesn't have the book on each of these hitters because he hasn't faced them, Callaway does. He knows where the holes are, and if he knows that Merritt, based on what he has worked with, and that's not been a lot, obviously, but if Mickey Callaway knows exactly where the breaking balls have to be and how, you know, who the biggest dangers are to hang them to, and if you're going to miss low, if you're going to miss outside, et cetera, Mickey Callaway is one of the best pitching coaches in baseball, and I don't think that can even be disputed. I say that not because his team is in the ALCS. I say that because look at his bullpen. I say that because look at his starting rotation. Look at all of the injuries and look at the production anyway.
Sure.
That's not coincidental. That is a great, great pitching coach, obviously working hand-in-hand with one of the best managers in baseball in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. Clearly, Terry Francona, two-time world champion, doing what he's doing now might be his best job ever managing a team. I think those two guys will have Ryan Merritt ready tonight for that reason, or today, I should say, at least in terms of what you just described, and Josh Tomlin in a potential Game 6.
Yeah, and really at the end of the day, we're spending a lot of time, understandably so, on, you know, Merritt and things like that. But to me, the real obvious key to this game is the fact that on an overall basis, the Indians as a team through four games really aren't hitting that much.
No.
You're going to need more than just one game that they've gotten this series out of Napoli in Game 3 or Kipnis in Game 3. Santana really hasn't done much. If any of them can string some hits together or one of them launch it out under the little bit warmer than the outside dome air, that's really what's going to be, because if there's any potential game in this entire series, despite the fact that it's Estrada for Toronto and he went that 8-inning complete game loss in Game 1, which was, of course, just 2-0,
yeah,
then it would be this game. And the Indians might have to try to get into a slugfest, but the problem is through four games, we haven't seen any evidence of that being possible.
No.
Now, baseball is funky like that, and you know the old adage, which you mentioned earlier, you're only as good as your next day's starting pitcher. Well, you know that's true in hitting as well, on the flip kind of way. And even if it's a good pitcher, sometimes guys just get off the schneid, and they're hitting well. And that's why, to me, all the talk of Merritt, and it's all legitimate, of course, don't get me wrong, but it won't matter if the Indians go out there and can only put up 2 runs on 5 hits anyway.
Yeah, and Estrada has given up 3 runs in 16 and a third postseason.
Yep,
innings.
He's been solid.
He has been tremendous. I mean, really tremendous, and obviously that 8-inning complete game in game number one really speaks for itself. So, and by the way, what's really interesting, though, is if I look at a little tail of the tape as far as the pitching matchup, you would think that the Indians have an enormous advantage. Here are the 2016 game stats for Ryan Merritt against Marco Estrada. ERA, Estrada 3.48. Ryan Merritt 1.64. WHIP, Estrada 1.12. Ryan Merritt 0.55. Opponent's batting average, Estrada 2.03. Ryan Merritt 1.67. Walks strikeout to walk ratio 2.54 for Estrada, 6 for Ryan Merritt. And WAR 3.4 for Estrada. Ryan Merritt only registered a 0.4 because, obviously, the reason I did all of that, tongue-in-cheek, the fact that he only had 11 innings.
Right.
But Ryan Merritt wins the tail of the tape, statistically speaking, against Marco Estrada. So the Indians have a huge advantage tonight.
Nice. I like what you did there. Makes me feel better.
In game number 5. All right. So we're going to get off of baseball for a little while. coming up after the bottom of the hour. We're going to shift gears to something we have not talked much about in the last month or so, even though the training camps and the preseason have been going strong. And I'm talking, of course, about the NBA. But we are going to get into the NBA because the annual GM survey has been completed. And a lot of really, really interesting revelations in terms of who the NBA general managers collectively feel is going to win the world championship, who are going to win the conferences, the divisions, who the best players are, the best shooters, et cetera, et cetera. It's always one of the fun times looking at what the GMs think, because they get to answer all of these questions anonymously and collected by the NBA, and it's on NBA.com right now. We'll tweet it out here, as a matter of fact, after we get into our sports center, and then we're going to talk a little bit about that on the flip side. But before we do all that, let me remind you to get yourself out to Sylvania, into Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe, the location of the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. We remind you this each and every day because it's, first of all, it's college football season in what might be a very, very memorable college football season for the teams that we love to cover and talk about and cheer for here in Northwest Ohio. The Buckeyes and the Wolverines, to say nothing of the rough season that the Irish are having. There's still a ton of fans around here. Spartans, Rockets, Falcons, and Tigers as well. The Buckeye Store and more. The Buckeyes are number two. The Michigan Wolverines are number three. Toledo has just one loss, steamrolling toward a potential MAC championship. So a lot of really, really great reasons to get to the Buckeye Store and more. There's 10% store-wide savings. No matter what your favorite team is, you're going to find a sale on it at the Buckeye Store and more. Hundreds of new Nike products are in stock, and hundreds of new products are arriving every day at the Buckeye Store and more in Sylvania and Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe. It's right next to Ralphie's. You'll see it there. Big Brutus is on the roof. Inflatable Brutus waving you into the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. More coming up on the extravaganza that should be after this.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Onward we roll. It's 3:46. We got a really interesting football conversation to have at about 4:10 this afternoon. We're going to talk to my friend Scott Petrak, who is an NFL beat writer, who wrote a piece today condemning Antonio Andrews, the running back for the Tennessee Titans, for his hit and for his social media post about Jordan Poyer, the hit that he laid on Poyer that he got a 15-yard penalty for and is probably going to face a fine for. My buddy Scott thinks it was a cheap shot. It was unnecessary. It should be fined. And he's even more upset about the fact that he's bragging about it on social media, calling himself relentless after sending Poyer to the hospital with a potential concussion and with a definite lacerated kidney. I'm going to agree and I'm going to disagree with Scott on a couple of different points there. I'm going to agree with him on the social media, but I'm going to disagree. And we're going to have it out. We're going to go toe-to-toe coming up at about 4:10. Then at 4:35 today, we're going to get back into college football. We heard from Coach Mike Jinks of BG yesterday. Of course, BG dropped the I-75 battle on Saturday to the Toledo Rockets. And now we're going to hear from the Rockets coach, the victorious Jason Candle, as they get ready for Central Michigan, again at the Glass Bowl coming up this Saturday. So Coach Candle at about 4:35. This afternoon. All right, but I want to go to the NBA now because I always love this. This is one of my favorite times of the year, one of my favorite stories of the year, I guess I might want to say, and that is when the NBA completes its 2016-2017 or its annual GM survey. And you know what this means. They ask GMs to anonymously answer all of these questions, okay, about the teams, the players, et cetera, that will be the stories of the league this year. The GMs responded to 48 different questions about the best teams, players, coaches, fans, and off-season moves. General managers, this is key, were not permitted to vote for their own team or their own personnel. So this isn't just, you know, stacking your own deck, if you will. The percentages are based on the pool of respondents to that particular questions rather than all 30 general managers. And here we go. Some of these are very, very fun. Some of them are just going to be, we're going to gloss over, and some we're going to actually discuss. The first one is, of course, regarding who is going to be the best team in the National Basketball Association in 2016-2017. There were only two teams that got votes. Everybody, every GM in basketball believes that either the Golden State Warriors or the Cleveland Cavaliers will win the 2017 NBA Finals. 69% say Golden State, 31% say Cleveland. So it's over 2-1. They believe that the Warriors are going to get revenge and win the rematch, or the three match, if you will, this trilogy between Golden State and Cleveland. They think it will be. But only one other team even got any votes at all, and that was 31%, and that was Cleveland. Nobody gives anybody else a chance. Any surprise there? Probably not. How about ranking the top four teams in the Eastern Conference? And again, you can't vote for your own team. This is what NFL GMs believe. 96.7% of them say the best team in the Eastern Conference will be the Cavaliers. The only other team to get a first-place vote or two, Boston, at 3.3%. That's it. The top four, according to the GMs, would be then Cleveland, Toronto, Boston, Indiana, and where do you think the Pistons came in? Right there at number five. Kush, that's right about where you kind of said, rather than squeaking in as the eighth seed in the playoffs last year, the way they did last year, you thought they could reach as high as maybe six or five this year. You still think
actually, I had said during this past offseason that they should be the number four. Now, we'll see how they are without Reggie Jackson as their point guard for about a month, and I bet that's what's playing into even the GM's notation here, having Indiana slightly over Detroit, because, like I said, when the offseason moves are basically done, I said Detroit should probably be number four in these.
Last year, if you're wondering, last year in this very same question, the order in the East was Cleveland at 96.6%, then Chicago, Atlanta, Miami, Washington, Toronto, and Milwaukee. Detroit did not even register.
Wow.
So at least it speaks to the progress, according to other GMs, that they're making under Stan Van Gundy. So they have the fifth spot there. In the Western Conference, GMs say 96.7% of them, just like in the East, it's Golden State. 3.3% first-place votes went to San Antonio. Nobody else got one. So the rankings there, Golden State, San Antonio, the Clippers, the Thunder, the top four in the Western Conference, and not too terribly different from last year. Last year it was Golden State, San Antonio, Oklahoma City, and then the Clippers. So just flip-flopping three and four. Who do you think that the NBA general managers chose as the 2016-17 preseason MVP? You might be surprised, because I was, to be quite honest with you. They chose, by a margin of 46.7%, to 23% for the runner-up, they chose LeBron James. Now, you might be saying, why are you surprised? LeBron James has already won that award four times. Yeah, it's true, but you know what he hasn't done? He hasn't won it in the last 3 years. It was Steph Curry last year. It was Steph Curry the year before. And it was Kevin Durant the year before that. He hasn't done it in 3 years, and I don't think, given his age, the number of miles on his body, even though he's still in his very early 30s, what is he, 31? He'll be 32 this year?
Yep.
Even though he is very young, he has played the equivalent of, this will be his 14th NBA season, but given all of the playoff games and all of the marches to the finals, he has played practically another season on top of that, and then some. So to me, I think LeBron James is going to get plenty of rest this year. And I think he's going to be kind of treated a little bit like Tim Duncan and some other guys. And he's going to miss, I don't know, 10, 12, 13, 14 games at various points in time due to various maladies or invented maladies, just to give him a night off.
I'd buy that, too. I think he, yeah, prepare for this, Cavs fans. He's going to sit out for, I think, 10 to 15, somewhere in that ballpark. But the voters, these GMs voting this way, that kind of doesn't surprise me. That's been one of the themes over the course of summer with you got Durant going to Golden State, so that dilutes the pool there, and LeBron may win it by default.
Well, it does, but with Durant going to Golden State, and then, you know, maybe Durant and Curry cancel each other out a little bit, because each of them sacrifice a few stats for the other. To me, the guy who finished second in this survey would be the guy that would be my first. Now that Russell Westbrook doesn't have to share the ball the way Steph Curry is now going to have to with Kevin Durant, and Russell Westbrook is already a walking triple-double. The guy is just incredible. Now he can just take that team on his shoulders and do what he wants with it. I can see him putting up just sickening numbers.
You know what? I absolutely can see him possibly being the one other guy who at least coming into the season has a real, real great chance at an MVP. Just on the basis of, think of where you were just reading the results from the Western Conference polling. If Oklahoma City, after losing Durant, is still number four, Westbrook may even have my vote for MVP.
That's right.
Even though I don't have a vote.
Nobody has ever done it. A lot of people thought maybe, you know, Magic could do it. Some people thought maybe LeBron could do it in his prime. Nobody has ever approached Oscar Robertson averaging a triple-double for an entire season before. But if anybody I think is capable of doing that, it is Russell Westbrook.
Yeah.
He leads the league in triple-doubles every year. He's going to average probably close to 30 points a game, if not more, now that Durant is gone. He's probably going to average about 9 assists a game. And if he can push that up over 10 and his rebounding is already up there too at around 7, 8, 9 again.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he could do some spectacular things.
I completely agree with that. Hey, real quick, I want to go back to these rankings because I couldn't help but notice that both Cavs and Golden State have this 96.7% for first place vote. Did you not say that a GM can't vote for their own team?
Correct.
Then that 3.3%, well, that's the Cavs voting for somebody,
that's
not Cleveland.
Voting for somebody else.
And the 3.3 to San Antonio is Golden State's guy voting for
not
them.
Griffin.
Yes.
And then who's the GM out of Golden State? I can't even remember.
I can't remember off the top of my head either. But
yeah,
I, just looking at those numbers again, that has to be why it's like that for both, because really it's probably 100%. But if you can't vote for your own team, then you got to vote for somebody else. So there you go.
Let me get to one of the more interesting votes in this survey of the NBA GMs this offseason. And as we get set for the start of the season, which is coming up exactly when? When is the lid lifter?
Six days. Pistons open a week from today, but the Cavs open on Tuesday, so that's 6 days from now.
If you were starting a franchise today and could sign any NBA player for your team, who would you sign to start your franchise? And this is the most controversial one, I think, of all. In third place is the four-time MVP and three-time NBA champion LeBron James. In second place is the one-time MVP and zero-time NBA champion Kevin Durant with 20%. LeBron was 17% of the vote. Kevin Durant with 20% of the vote. In first place, the guy, now these are GMs, not fans. The player that GMs overwhelmingly say they would start their franchise with today is Karl Anthony Towns of the Minnesota Timberwolves. Karl Anthony Towns got 48% of the responses from the NBA GMs today. Then Durant, then James, also receiving votes. Curry, Anthony Davis of New Orleans, Kawhi Leonard, Russell Westbrook. Last year, the answer to that question was Anthony Davis, 86%. What I want to know is why are GMs so invested in starting a franchise with one of these young, great upside guys rather than one of these already superstar guys who are going to the finals year after year after year after year? Wouldn't you want, if you're starting a franchise, the guy who's going to go to the finals year after year after year and then and really get your franchise started off on the right foot? How do you not go with LeBron James or, you know, Steph Curry? How do you go with, or even Kevin Durant, even though he hasn't won one yet? How do you go with Karl Anthony Towns, no matter how good his upside is?
Well, the interesting part is I think you just kind of answered your own question. Since we're talking GMs voting here, this gives this the answer to this question, although, it, you know, the results may sound controversial to us, now that I think about it, attempting to put a GM hat on my head that I don't really have, the youth factor is the only thing that I could think of here from a GM point of view why the vote would be like this.
I get it. I understand
that. I get that, but
who can be their guy for the next, you know, 10, 12, 13 years. Okay. But if you ask me, you know, LeBron James at 31, I would rather be pushing toward a championship in the next 3 or 4 years than hope that this guy can become anywhere close to that over the next 13.
And that's the interesting part in basketball specifically on this question. Yeah. I would have taken a LeBron or a Durant or a Curry, someone a little older, someone a little more established as my number one pick. When I get to my number two pick, then I'm going after somebody like a Karl Anthony Towns.
Yes, I think that's fair. That's exactly what I would say is fair as well. I just can't believe that they would start their team. And I know, again, like you said, it's the young factor. That's why, you know, they're looking into the future. That's why last year it was Anthony Davis, of course, the unibrow. I get all of that. I'm just trying to be realistic about what would you rather have. I would rather have a championship in my first 2 or 3 years that I have one of the greatest players in the history of the game on my side for, even if he is less than that in 10 years. than have 10 years of mediocrity and hoping this guy
right.
can rise to anything close to where I've seen the other guys already rise.
And I see where you're, you know, where you're going with that. And that's why this answer, even though it sounds controversial, less than to a degree it is, this answer more than I think any of the others gives us an interesting insight into how GMs think. Sure, they want the big player now, but they also don't want to screw up 5 years from now, clearly. Right. And that's part of why the vote is the way it is on this one. That's the only conclusion I can come with. Very interesting insight to GM minds with that one.
It really is very interesting. I agree. And there's a lot more on this survey. We got to get a timeout now, though, for the top of the hour Sports Center. But it's really, really, they're really good stuff. Best point guard in the NBA is Steph Curry over Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook. Best shooting guard is James Harden over Klay Thompson. Best small forward, no question there. It's LeBron, then Durant. Best power forward is, how about that? LeBron James gets second best in power forward.
I saw that. That was great.
Best center, DeAndre Jordan of the Clippers. Let's see. Who else? Oh, and let's see. Best overall offseason moves, et cetera. There's a lot of really good stuff here, and we don't have a lot of time to get into it because we're going to have a football fight on the other side of the Sports Center here at the top of the hour. Hey, and while we're at it, let's do something fun for you. I've got, speaking of football, I got an opportunity for you to go to the College Football National Championship game. If you'd like to head to Tampa, Florida, and the College Football Championship game, which is on January 9th, you can do it. If you you can qualify for that grand prize drawing. You get a round-trip airfare, trip for two, round-trip airfare, a four-night hotel stay, two upper-level tickets to the game, rental car with parking, and a tour of the Yuengling Brewery in Tampa. That's a $5,000 prize package. If you come in second in this contest drawing, you'd get a trip to Columbus for the Ohio State-Michigan game November 26th with limo service, and the third-place prize, a great prize package from Yuengling. All you got to do is register now at 1065theticket.com. You can do that once a day, or just call 866-240-1065. Fifth caller right now will be registered for that outstanding prize. Good luck to you from Yuengling Lager, York Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, Ram, Country Hearth, Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air, Toledo Express Airport, Total Image Limousine, and, of course, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. Talking a little football coming up next. Was the Poyer hit a cheap and dirty one, or is it just football? And are the skirts starting to win over in the National Football League? Coming up right here.
You know, when you're down one, trying to keep it at one so we have a chance. Also recognizing that if Miller and Cody pitched, that would have been 4 out of 5. Pretty high stress, high leverage innings. Decided to try to go a different route. Didn't work out as well as we wanted, but you're right. We do have those guys available with a day off behind it. We're trying to win the game. I mean, we talked to Kluber after every inning, and I thought he held his stuff real good. I thought his legs started to get a little bit tired.
I made a mistake to Donaldson, but other than that, I felt fine out there. I think that you get so much adrenaline in these games that, you know, if there was any extra fatigue or anything like that, I think it probably goes away pretty quickly. Try to win one more game. I mean, you know, we're one win away from the World Series. I think that's what we're focused on.
So that's a good lineup over there. Whenever they put the ball in play and they're able to move some guys around, and they're able to put up runs. You know, they got, like I said, they got a good team, but you know, so do we. And our bullpen, our pitching, you know, normally does the job, and we just didn't go our way today. Got in a great position. You know, we're still up. Just going in tomorrow with the same mindset. You know, keep putting that work, and you know, just go out there. You know, like I said, have a little bit of fun. You know, let it hang out. And just do our business.
I'm going to try to go out there, have fun, relax, pitch to my strengths, not let the game speed up on me. Trust in myself, trust in my defense, to go out there and compete, try to win a game for us. Right here, boiling down to the World Series, you know, it's a different feeling, you know. I'm just really excited to be able to have this opportunity and chance to help the Indians.
For me, when I first saw it, you know, it kind of angered me, you know, because to hit a guy blindside, if you're going head up with a man and you beat a man face to face and he sees you, you see him, all right, cool. But if you're a special teams guy and you're popping that stuff on there, like, you know, you're some type of superhero or something, and you're just because you're hitting a guy blindsided and you think that's cool, that's where the problem comes in. So I think he should stay to his special teams and what he does, and don't, you know, post stuff when a man's not looking, you know, and taking a hit like that.
I understand where Jordan's coming from. I mean, that probably happens literally all the time, though. I've seen it happen before. You know, it's unfortunate. Like I said, we're just praying for, you know, Jordan makes a speedy recovery and Jordan's back in the locker room.
Certainly, you'd hope that there was some sensitivity involved when, you know, a guy does go to the hospital because of a hit. I think that's one thing that I'd like to see the NFL do is not use highlights of plays that were penalties, like celebrating, you know. If you celebrate with the football, they like to use that as a way to market the game, but yet they fine and penalize players for it. Same thing with the big hits.
The only thing I didn't like was when the guy posted it bragging, you know, relentless. What is relentless about that? Hitting the guy, another man, when he's not looking. I love Poirier like a brother, and that really angered me. And we could go to the next question, but that was bullcrap.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Was it bullcrap, though? That is the question. Was it bullcrap, and what was bullcrap? Was the hit on Jordan Poirier bullcrap? Was the posting on social media of the relentless video, was that bullcrap? I got news for you. In my view, there is a yes and a no. And my friend Scott Petrak, who covers the Cleveland Browns out in Cleveland, a longtime beat reporter, he is going to disagree and tell me yes and yes. They were both bullcrap. And Scott Petrak joins us now right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Scotty, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon. Since I read your column today, and by the way, it's kind of cool. When I Googled Jordan Poirier hit, you were the first hit that came up. Article, your column today on Browns analysis about the relentless hit being unnecessary. So very, very cool. You got a ton of people, I'm sure, around the country reading and reacting to your view on this. And I'm lucky that I know you, because I want to react to your view personally and tell you that I totally agree with the part that you wrote today about relentless being unnecessary. Why is he posting this as if it was, something that was cool, when you had your fellow player, your fellow NFLPA member, even though you're not a teammate of his, you are brothers under the union umbrella, and these guys, generally speaking, do consider one another to be, you know, colleagues. You sent him to the hospital. He had a serious injury, a lacerated kidney, and maybe even a concussion. I don't understand why he would want to post that and make it look like something he's proud of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm with you 100% on that, Bob. I think it's probably because he's a guy that not a whole lot of people know. I mean, I'm not familiar with Antonio Andrews, and maybe he thought, you know, he made a highlight play and was going to try to get as much mileage out of it as possible. But I agree with you, you know, and some of the players talked about it today. There should be a code among NFL players, and to celebrate when a guy is in the hospital for something you did just doesn't seem right at all.
That's a great point. And that's what we're talking about. You don't celebrate somebody, a hit on somebody that is in the hospital because of it. Now, you can argue and you can discuss and debate in the media or elsewhere if you want that you shouldn't have gotten flagged, because I think he's got a case there. You can argue that you certainly don't deserve a fine, because I certainly think he's got a case there. But you can't argue that this was a cool thing and look at this, I'm relentless. No, you did your job on special teams. You blocked a guy that needed to be blocked. You needed it extraordinarily hard, and it took him out of a play. You can argue you did your job, but you can't celebrate that as if it's some kind of a cool thing or some kind of feather in your cap to knock somebody from a game. You know, your idea, your job there is to knock him from the play and not allow him to tackle your punt returner. But you can't knock somebody from the game and into the hospital and say, yeah, I'm relentless. I completely agree. And all of the guys we just heard from there in that montage, including Poirier, Andrew Hawkins, Joe Thomas, and Terrell Pryor, they all kind of have the same feeling here, that this is not something you're supposed to celebrate. But, Scotty,
right, and, you know, this may support your argument when we talk about the actual hit, mm-hmm. but the Browns, the furor among the Browns players and even Coach Hugh Jackson is because of the Instagram post. It's not necessarily because of the hit. Hugh Jackson called it a football play. He understands why it was penalized, but he didn't take exception to that. Today, he took exception to the Instagram post, said he'd be disappointed if one of his players did. He mentioned the code that he thinks it should be among NFL players. So that's where the kind of the fired up aspect in the Browns locker room came from, the Instagram post. And it especially didn't sit well when Poirier's still in the hospital in Nashville and can't get out of there, and the guy's posting that on Instagram.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's the key here. It is the celebration of it by posting it on Instagram that should rub people the wrong way. It rubs me the wrong way. I mean, I the moment it happened, I got on Twitter and said, why is that a penalty? My God in heaven, this is football. This is a block. This is not a guy who was 15 yards away from the play and not involved. He was 3 yards away from the punt returner, was Poirier, and in hot pursuit and about to make a tackle or trying to make a tackle, and it is the job of the punt return team to block the guys trying to make tackles. And I immediately said, they need to change the, you know, just change the name of this penalty to what it really is. You hit him too hard. In football, we like hitting, but not hitting too hard, because there was nothing illegal or dirty about the play. There was no intent to injure. There was an intent to blow up a guy who was 3 yards away from making a tackle on the punt returner. So, and I think that's what Hugh Jackson said, and that's exactly what he was right about. He hit him too hard. The celebratory nature of the fact that somebody is in hospital by posting it on Instagram, I think everybody in both Tennessee and in Cleveland and here in Toledo and around the country, any NFL fan, no matter where you are, I think celebrating somebody's injury or going into the hospital is just beyond the pale. That's something nobody can agree with.
Well, no, you're right. But I do, you're right about that. And we agree completely on that, Bob. But I disagree with the fact that it's just a matter of hitting a guy too hard. The NFL, we know that they've tried to improve player safety, and now it's, you know, it's one of the things that they is at the top of their list. You know, we're going to improve player safety, and it's a big focus. And I watch all the videos that they send out to players and teams from the officiating crews, you know, the head of officiating. And that play has been targeted for years as something they're trying to get rid of. And the primary reason is because the player doesn't see it coming and is more susceptible to injury.
And this is my problem. It is absolutely not the blocker's fault if the defensive player doesn't have his head on a swivel and isn't looking around. Now, let's think about that for a moment. Here's Antonio Andrews doing his job blocking. He sees the punt returning coming up the left side, outside the hash toward the left sideline. Here's Jordan Poyer in hot pursuit, which he was. And again, he's just doing his job. Poyer's doing his job. It's really a great play pretty much all the way around. He's got a great angle on the tackle. And he's about to come over. Like I said, he's within about 3 yards at the time of the impact here. Now here comes Antonio Andrews. And he sees the defender. And he sees him. He's about to become a tackler here. And he's got to block him. Is he supposed to, on the fly, Scott, is he supposed to say, I have to wait until his head turns. I have to wait until he sees me. I can't block him unless he sees me. I can't light this guy up until he turns his head, at which time it might be too late if he never turns his head. Obviously, where are Jordan Poyer's eyes? On the guy he's trying to tackle. He's not going to turn around and look at Antonio Andrews. He's going to look at the ball carrier, the punt returner in this case. So if you have to wait for somebody to look at you before you can block him, then we've just taken blocking out of football. We've just taken contact, essentially, out of football here. Because all Antonio Andrews did was block a guy who was a direct danger to the ball carrier in this case, the guy who's about to tackle and stop the gain that the punt returner is making. And if he has to wait for the guy to look at him, well, then we just might as well say we're not allowed to block anymore.
Well, no, I mean, it's not he has to look at you. It's that you're not allowed to block.
That's what a blindside hit means, isn't it? And what they call. They're saying blindside, meaning the guy didn't see it coming. So if the guy doesn't see you coming, you can't hit him.
I know, but that's what they call it, Bob. But the rule is, because you're not allowed to block a guy in the head and neck area when the blocker is headed back toward his own goal line. That's what the penalty is. It has nothing to do with whether or not Jordan Poyer had his eyes on the blocker. It's the direction the blocker's taking. And the reason for that is because a guy like Jordan Poyer, a guy in the coverage unit, is considered, quote-unquote, defenseless. And you can argue that he's not defenseless, and that's fine. But that's the rule. These players have been coached against doing that. It's been a rule for at least 2 years now. He knows better. And the reason that rule is instituted is because that player in that situation is more susceptible than other players of getting injured. This isn't a guy who sees everything coming. It's not, you know, it's not like a receiver who's making a play and the safety bang, bang hit. This Jordan Poyer, and you can argue he should have his head on a swivel or not, but the NFL has studied and found that these guys are more susceptible to big hits, huge collisions, and big time injuries, whether it's concussions, lacerated kidneys. So that's why they're trying to take that out of the game, and that makes all the sense in the world to me.
See, it doesn't to me, because if that's the argument, then change the game. You know what? Get rid of games or plays in which guys are going to be going full speed chasing a returner, and other guys are going to be going full speed and trying to block them. And they already started to do that with the kickoff rule, and then just take punting out of the game. Because you know what? This is a contact sport, and I know you know this. You've been around this game as long as I have, probably longer than I have, even though we're about the same age. We've all been watching this. We all saw the NFL Crunch Course videos on VHS. We saw ESPN as little as a decade ago doing the jacked up segment and celebrating big hits like this. Okay, you don't want to celebrate them anymore, as we just pointed out, with the Instagram thing. You don't want to celebrate them. But to me, you also can't outlaw them. This is a very violent game, and when you are going full speed, you're going to have violent collisions. And now they're basically saying, don't commit a violent collision. And I'll tell you something else. I'm staring at two different angles of that hit. and I'm staring at both of them on video freeze-framed. And this is not a head-and-neck collision. His left shoulder, Antonio Andrews' left shoulder, is literally in the chest plate, of Jordan.
And then his
Porter's
head hits
shoulder
his head.
Pads. I'm sorry?
And then in the next second, his head hits his head. The helmet's a face mask.
And then, well, no, I mean, it doesn't. It does because the impact is made by the shoulder pad, which is exactly what the rule says you can do, and it's made to the chest area. The fact that Poirier's head automatically goes down because, you know, he's being impacted, if you hit yourself in the chest, I mean, you can do it right now. I just did it. If you smack yourself in the chest, it's going to make your own head bob forward. But he did not initiate a helmet-to-helmet hit in any way. He initiated a shoulder-to-chest hit, which is 100% legal because the chest is part of your torso. And if that makes your head snap down, and the face mask impacts the helmet below it, that is not the defender creating a helmet-to-helmet or helmet-to-face mask hit. That is physics, is all that is. So if we're going to try to outlaw physics, man, then we just got to outlaw the punting game and outlaw the kicking game altogether and make everything from the line of scrimmage.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
If he could have kept Jordan Poirier from making the tackle, which is the job, isn't to kill Jordan Poirier. It's not to cause a concussion. The job is to keep him from making a tackle. If he could have done that with a shove to the shoulder or a nudge to the side or whatever it is that doesn't require, that doesn't have everybody go, oh, then why didn't he do that?
Well, let me answer your question with a question. If a safety can shove a wide receiver to the ground after he makes a catch instead of trying to separate him from the ball or to rock him on a hit, again, not to the head, But a hit to the body, to the torso. If he can shove him instead of hitting him, should he shove him?
I think it depends on the circumstance, Bob. And I think that's where this is a gray area. And I think you have to be willing to accept that there's different hits, and there's different hits, in my opinion, that are necessary to football. If you're going to play quote-unquote football, these hits are necessary. And I don't think the one we saw Sunday falls into that category.
See, I think this is, you're right. It is a gray area. And the reason I answered your question with my question is both guys would absolutely, should not be forced to shove somebody. Because it's not just about making that tackle for that safety. It's not just about making that block for this guy. It's making that guy have that much more trepidation the next time he comes into that area of the field. The next time there's punt, this guy isn't going to be so aggressive in coverage, which might give my guy the edge he needs to make that last cut and get around him and to score a touchdown. We block and we tackle when we play football as hard as we can, not just for the sake of that play, but for the sake of every play thereafter. Intimidating your opponents, making them a little bit fearful of, man, where is that dude? That dude just lit somebody up. That's the name of this game, and it has been for decades, and they're trying to take that out of the game, Scotty, and that's where I just can't. I know we want to make the game safe, but you can't tell guys, hey, if you can hit lighter, hit lighter. If you can just shove instead of hit, well, then shove. Because if that's what we're doing, then we got to reinvent the game altogether.
Well, I get you. I understand exactly what you're saying, Bob. But I think there are places where you can try to legislate those type of hits out of the game. And they tried to do it with kickoffs, and we'll see if that continues to evolve where we no longer have kickoffs. And to me, this one makes sense. So, and you know, they've also gotten rid of the crackback block where the receiver comes flying down the line and blows up the defensive end or the linebacker who's not looking on kind of a sweep play. You can only do it within so many yards of the line of scrimmage, or there's some parameters for why that's now illegal. And it's because those defenders were quote unquote defenseless. And to me, that has to be the next step, because we know more now than we did 5, 10, 20 years ago about injuries, specifically about concussions. And if you don't react to that, then we might not have a game of football 30 years from now.
Yeah, I understand about crackbacks, and I think that is a little bit different, too, because you do have a guy that is literally a sitting duck. He's a sitting target. He's watching the play straight ahead. And again, we talk about head on the swivel. Now, I will say this. We crack back at the eighth grade level. My son's on an eighth grade football team, and we have crackbacks. And by the way, he plays wing, which means sometimes he split wide and does the cracking. He also happens to play outside linebacker, where he gets cracked. And the head has to be in front. And it can't be a clip, but it is a legal play, and we tell these kids all the time, if you're cracking, make sure that your head is in the front, and if you are playing that outside linebacker or a defensive end position where you're getting cracked, you've got to have your head on a swivel. Make sure you're looking, read your keys, look to your left or look to your right, wherever it is, and see if somebody's coming, and if so, you got to go blow that guy up before he gets due to crack on you or avoid him or whatever the case might be. So we're teaching kids, and we're still cracking in junior high. I feel like the players at the highest level of the game ought to know how to handle that. But I do understand the point, because you don't want guys, you know, to be sitting ducks. But if you're going to have punt and coverage and kick coverage, you're going to have full speed collisions no matter how hard you try to legislate that out of it. And to me, the only way to legislate out of it, you know, this is turning Antonio Andrews into a dirty player, which he is not.
Right.
But the league is going to view it as that. Because there's going to be high speed collisions, blocks and tackles at the, you know, especially at the NFL level, as long as we have, you know, those full speed 50-60 yard running head start type of plays involved. And if they want to get rid of punts and kickoffs, then you know what, let's be expeditious about it and just get it done. Stop trying to whittle it away one fine at a time, because I just think that's unfair to the players.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with it, because I think you can still have a punt return without this kind of play. I think he could have handled it differently. And we'll see if the NFL finds it. He doesn't
expect
it.
I still don't know how you tell a guy, Scotty, to slow up when you're going to block that guy. Slow up and just push him. Just shove him. Don't hit him when they've been conditioned to hit for their entire lives.
Well, to me, Bob, I know you disagree with that mm-hmm. with me. I think that's something you can teach, and I think that would make it, I know it would make it safer, and I don't have any problem with that change. It would, as a football fan, it wouldn't bother me if I didn't see a guy get blown up like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it bothers me in that it's the beginning of the end to me, Scotty. If you tell a guy on punt coverage you have to slow up and block this guy, and you know, especially if he doesn't see you coming, and he's a threat to make the tackle, he's in hot pursuit. It's not 15. You know, they put that rule in a few years ago about somebody, even if it's legal straight up, and even if he sees you coming, you can't block a guy who's not a material part of the play. If he's so far away that he's not a danger
right,
to make
right.
the tackle, et cetera. I get that. But when a guy is a part of the play and he's about to make the tackle, or is a danger to make the tackle, and your job is to block, if we say don't block too hard, that changes immediately. That just changes the nature of the game. And the next thing is, hey, safeties, don't hit too hard. Hey, linebacker coming up to stuff the run, don't hit him too hard. If you knock him backwards and put him into concussion protocol, well, that's going to be a fine. It just is the very next step toward we got to soften the game up. We've got to, you know, and I understand we want to keep the players safe, but we are essentially taking the contact out of contact football.
Well, it's also a matter of where he contacted him, and I know you're looking at the video where he gets him in the chest. The Browns had a play that was almost the exact same in the preseason. Tank Carter lights up the punter from the other team, and when I saw it live, I couldn't believe he did it. It looked dirty to me, and to me, he went and sought out the punter, and there's no need for that. But the league looked at it and said it was fine because the shoulder was more in the abdomen, and it was the shoulder of the abdomen. There was nothing near the head. It just the head snapped back because it was such a big blow. And the NFL said that was fine. To me, this was much higher. I thought it was closer to the neck. I thought the helmet to face mask contact was almost instantaneous. And that's where I think you have to draw the line.
Yeah, and you know what I'm going to do, Scotty? I'm going to send you my screenshot. And I'm sure you've seen it already, but I'm taking a screenshot of the freeze frame video where you can see, like I said, Poyer's head is completely, literally, at the point of contact, up and down. And the head of Andrews is below that. It is below his face mask. It is below his neck. His shoulder is in the chest area. And you will see then, if you speed it up from there or basically push play after the freeze frame,
right.
that's when, because of the impact to the chest, the head just completely drops forward, which, of course, means face mask to helmet. But it is not the defender, or excuse me, the blocker, hitting the defender helmet to face mask. It is simply it's a physical reaction, physics reaction to a hit to the chest, which, again, they have not outlawed, at least as far as I know, at least not yet. And that, of course, is going to be coming, I'm sure, sometime soon. Scotty, always great work. Thanks for the great discussion, the great article. You make some outstanding points, obviously, and I can completely respect the idea of trying to protect the players, but I also do want to respect the integrity of contact tackle football and to take so much contact away that a blocker now is suddenly the bad guy for the block. What makes him a bad guy is the Instagram post, not the block.
Yeah, right.
That is a
well, we can agree on that, buddy.
Yeah, that is a very bad thing, and the Browns are right to be upset by that. And you know what? I think as I heard Jordan Poyer, though, of all the guys, Jordan Poyer even said this isn't about the hit. He really didn't even have much of a problem with the hit, but he was very disappointed and offended by the fact that the guy would celebrate it on Instagram in such a way. And to me, that says an awful lot, too, when you listen to Jordan Poyer. Scotty, great work. Thanks for the time, man. We appreciate it. I know we haven't talked a couple of Fridays because we've had baseball coverage going on, but we'd love to talk to you again about the weekend's games coming up. All right?
Sounds good, bud.
Thanks much. Appreciate it. All right, 4:34. We're going to get to college football coming up next here after this bottom of the hour Sports Center, a little bit past the bottom of the hour Sports Center. We got college football, and right now before talking to Jason Candle, FYI, that's who the college football conversation is with, the head coach of UT. But before we get there, let's get you into fright mode, the Haunted Hydro in Fremont. I got another pair of tickets. We've been giving them away all month long. Let's do it again. Caller number 10 to 866-240-1065. You want to go to Haunted Hydro? Hydro in Fremont, the tickets are yours. Caller 10, 866-240-1065. Jason Candle coming up next.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back into the Extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here. Time to talk some college football. Toledo Rockets get the win back on Saturday in the Battle of I-75. 42-35, the much closer score in this one against Bowling Green. 5-1 now stand the Rockets. And to help us talk all things Toledo Rocket football, we welcome in the head coach of the Rockets. He is Jason Candle. Hi, Coach. Thanks again for joining us.
Afternoon. Thanks for having me.
42-35. I was commenting back on Friday when I was looking through some picks that you guys were favored by 31. Boy, if we needed another textbook dictionary definition of throw those records out when it comes to rivalry games, that's what we saw back on Saturday at the Glass Bowl.
Well, you're talking about a senior class from that team down south that's really proud of their tradition and proud of what they and stand for a lot. They've played in a lot of meaningful games, and to beat Toledo their last time out would have been a very good thing for them to get accomplished. So we knew we were going to get their best effort. We knew it was going to be a tough football game. I think they're a football team that has found their identity, you know, on offense and defense and special teams, you know, as the season has went on. So, you know, new staff is sometimes really hard to figure out and get, you know, things in order, you know. So I think that's a team that'll compete the rest of the way out for sure. But give credit to our team. We won the game. And, finish the game with good poise and composure there, going on the last drive to get a touchdown to get the thing closed out. So really proud of our team, really proud of our seniors to go win 7 times in a row against that team. That's something that this senior class will, you know, be able to care for. You know, carry with them the rest of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely, Coach. And this game was back and forth. It was very entertaining all throughout. Bowling Green gets a couple of fourth quarter touchdowns, and suddenly it's 35 all. You guys get one last possession, and you're talking about how poised your guys were. Walk me through that last Rocket possession. Went 66 yards, ended with Kareem Hunt's only touchdown of the day to put you guys back on top.
Yeah, I think, really good job by Jordan Fisher of fielding the kick, kicking into the wind there. And, you know, they got a sky kick, and it was a tough kick to get fielded. He did. And then we were able to, put our offense out there and go down and, convert a couple meaningful downs and, to be able to take all the clock, finish it off, and punch it in, to Kareem to finish it off like that. You know, certainly an exclamation point on a great day, and, certainly would be missing if I didn't mention what an outstanding crowd we had at the game, and certainly want to thank all the Rocket listeners and supporters that, showed up for our game Saturday, and I think that's a great representation of what, Toledo football should be and what the Glass City represents. So certainly an awesome day on homecoming weekend and, for Toledo, and we're really proud and happy to get that win.
Well said on that front, Coach. We're talking to head coach Jason Candle of the Toledo Rockets. 42-35, they get the win back on Saturday at the Glass Bowl in the I-75 rivalry against Bowling Green. Another, it started to become another day at the office for Logan Woodside, 23-30, 322, 4 touchdowns, did have the pick. You're getting solid performance after solid performance from this guy.
Yeah, his mistakes on the year, too. I mean, not to throw anybody else under the bus, but his interceptions this year have come on, 2 tip balls and drop ball and, 1 bad decision he made at BYU. So, for the most part, he's done exactly what we've asked him to do. He's taking care of the football, and really doing a great job of leading our team down to and putting touchdown drives together. So doing a great job of distributing the ball to a multitude of different receivers, guys that have just continued each week to rise up when called upon. And certainly, when you're able to do that and mix that with a good, strong running game, you're tough to defend.
And let's talk about that strong running game. You got 112 on just 12 carries, a score, one of them a 63-yard carry from Swanson. And then Kareem Hunt doesn't get over 100 yards, gets you 25 carries, 99, and he gets that final touchdown in the final drive. And it's as we talked about many times here, Coach, it's so nice to be able to deploy more than one outstanding back that
just has to keep defenses on their toes.
Yeah, I mean, they continue to keep practicing hard and keep trying to earn carries and earn their, you know, earn their way. You know, we got a couple, you know, linemen dinged up in the game, and it was good to see some of those young offensive linemen come in and to be in there on that last drive to be part of a meaningful game and to really play well. So, you know, really encouraged by, you know, that standpoint of it. But, yeah, them backs, they've been rock solid all year long.
We're talking with head coach Jason Candle of the Toledo Rockets, Jim Cushlin, here on the Extravaganza. Let's talk about your defense in this one. Did give up 35 to the Falcons, who have struggled, as we know, at times this year. And you were just talking about, from your angle, some of the young guys in that last drive able to get in and get some real significant playing time. Bowling Green has been doing that for some weeks now. They've been starting a freshman quarterback for a few weeks now, and they were able to do some things against you defensively. Is that more of a factor of... you don't have full scouting necessarily on some of these young guys, even though they played a few games for the Falcons, or was this just one of those games where you could just use the cliches and throw the records out, because that's what happens sometimes in rivalry games?
No, I don't think it's something that we didn't know about our opponent. I think it's they're on scholarship too. I mean, you know, they that's a team, like I said, that played in the title game last year and has played in a lot of meaningful football games here. So. Over the last few years. So, and a lot of guys on that team, you know, are veteran players. So, you know, I think that that's a team that has continued to get better each and every week and will continue to get better. You know, they made some plays on us, but like I said, they got some good players who, you know, when they get the ball in their hand, they can score it from anywhere. And certainly they got loose on us a couple times Saturday. We got to get it corrected and get it fixed and, you know, get ready for this week's opponent here coming to Glassville, because this is a good team coming in here Saturday.
And we'll get to that opponent here in just a minute. One last quick question just for you on this game, since it's your first in the head coaching spot in terms of this rivalry game. And you were talking about how great the crowd was, combined with the fact it was homecoming for the Rockets. Your thoughts just for you, Coach, of being part of this rivalry now for the first time?
Well, it isn't any different for me as far as to move up and to be the head coach. I think, you know, being a part of it the last, you know, 6 or 7 years as an assistant has given me an appreciation for what, you know, that game means to both communities, to both, you know, towns, and certainly, you know, what it means in Northwest Ohio. You know, you have the Unity Breakfast on Friday before the game that the FCA sponsors and puts on, and you get 400 or 500 people in a room for that. And I think there's just a lot of things that surround that game that, like I said, mean a lot to our region and mean a lot to Northwest Ohio. So, proud to be a part of it, you know, love coaching in it, you know, think it's really good for our community, really good for the sport of college football, and rivalry, I hope, continues forever.
And let's get to that next opponent now, Coach. We're talking with head coach Jason Candle of the Toledo Rockets. Back at the Glass Bowl, high noon on Saturday, you take on a Central Michigan team, not too shabby in their own right, but you guys right now do stand 2-0 in MAC play. So walk me through some of the things you're looking to be able to do in this one.
Well, you got a sound football team coming in, a team that's won on the road and won at Oklahoma State, went on the road and won at Northern Illinois last week. You know, a team that's, you know, kind of in a situation in the conference race on our side that, you know, probably if you ask them, couldn't afford to lose another game to get to where they want to go. So, you know, I think it's a very important game from that, you know, regard, and certainly a team that I think is a physical, sound football team in all three phases, very well coached, very disciplined and not going to beat themselves. You know, we have to get off to a fast start and get rolling early. It's a noon kickoff, something that, you know, we're not really accustomed to around here, but we got to get out and get ready to roll and get moving, because, like I said, it'll be a stiff challenge for us for sure.
If there's one thing Central Michigan can do that you're trying to put some extra attention on, what would that be?
Well, I think their quarterback is a great player. You know, he's you know, mentioned by, you know, numerous people as, you know, a potential draft pick and a, you know, a potential high draft pick, and rightfully so. You know, he's had some good games against us in the past, and certainly some great games in huge environments his time at Central Michigan and beating some really, really good teams. So, you know, we got to try to make him uncomfortable. Got to get him some situations where, you know, he can hopefully force him to make some mistakes, and we can take advantage of him.
Now, and I'm sure I'll go over this a little bit more in depth when I talk with you next time, but I couldn't help but notice on the schedule after this game at Central Michigan. Luckily, you guys stay at home at the Glass Bowl, but shifting immediately after this one to those weekday games after Central Michigan, you're only going to have, by my count, what is it, 4 days off before you welcome in Ohio, one of the possible favorites in the East. Again, I know I'll probably go more in depth on this with you next time we talk, but how's that? Your thoughts on having such kind of a short break between games coming up after this one?
Yeah, it is what it is. Midweek action, it begins. So, yeah, I mean, that's what the schedule that was given to us, that's what it dictates, that's what it says that we have to do, so that's what we'll do. And we'll do the best of our ability and get ready to play, and that'll be another challenge. I mean, look, I mean, in October and November, you know, you're playing for something, and, you know, that's all you can ask for. Get yourself in a position to keep playing for something that's meaningful, get your guys prepared, and go give it your best.
We're talking with head coach Jason Candle of the Toledo Rockets. Central Michigan coming into the Glass Bowl coming up on Saturday. Rockets now 2-0 in MAC play. They are 5-1 overall in the season. And, yeah, it's going to be an interesting turnaround, win or lose on Saturday after this one, then 4 days off before the Ohio Bobcats come in next Thursday, the 27th, to begin the weekday games. Coach, best of luck out there on Saturday. We'll be watching, and hope when we reconvene next week, we'll talk about another Rockets win.
Thanks, Jim.
That is head coach of the Toledo Rockets, Jason Candle, joining us. It'll be Central Michigan coming to the Glass Bowl. High noon for the kick. And, yeah, given the way the Rockets have, you have your Maction games, a couple of Friday games, the opener, the one at BYU. So the way schedules now go for Toledo and MAC teams, high noon Saturday starts are actually becoming the minority. That's the case, though, in this one. And Central Michigan's a solid team, and they have a lot to still play for. They really are in a position, the way the West Division is shaking out with the Rockets and still undefeated and ranked Western Michigan, that really one more loss if you're Central and you're probably out of this thing. Most likely we are looking at Toledo, Western Michigan down the stretch anyway, and that's going to make the Black Friday game in Kalamazoo. By the way, last day of the regular season is going to be probably for all the marbles, but Central Michigan is going to try to make some say some things about that, because right now your MAC West shapes up. You got Western 3-0, 7-0. Rockets are 2-0, 5-1, still hanging around. 2-1, 5-2 each for Central and Eastern Michigan. At this point, only Ball State and, yes, you're hearing this right, Northern Illinois, probably the only teams truly out of the West Division race at this point. But, yeah, for Central, they really need this one. With Western and Toledo doing what they're doing and then starting to lose tiebreakers, you can't afford to be basically two games behind in the conference standings after this weekend, because this is really, for all practical purposes, the last weekend before full on Maction begins. The Bowling Green Falcons, by the way, they will get a week off after this one, but the Rockets are only getting 4 days off before they reconvene on Thursday, October 27th, for the beginning of their weekday games. So this is an important one for the Rockets, and luckily they get them at the Glass Bowl. And defensively is the thing I'm going to be watching for in this one, only because we know the struggles of Bowling Green this year. And yes, the rivalry game concept did show up back on Saturday, a game that was once a 31-point spread, ended up being decided just by 7 points, which is exactly how you'd want it to be, of course, in rivalry games. I'm sure some of the fans were nervous, but as Coach mentioned, it wasn't, and I saw it too, it was an absolutely fantastic crowd at the Glass Bowl back on Saturday. But defensively, they got to shore some things up, because if they don't, then it's going to be a lot more than just 35 points, the way Bowling Green did. And Bowling Green still, don't get me wrong, still has some weapons, but as we know, they've had their struggles this year, and they're also now starting to cycle through a lot of the younger guys. So this is an important game, I think, from a Toledo Rocket defensive standpoint more than anything else. We know what we're going to get offensively with that receiving core, getting the ball thrown to him by Logan Woodside, who just keeps bringing in big-time numbers after big-time numbers. He's very, very, very soon going to be the Rockets touchdown passes leader, I believe it is. So he's coming right up, and Kareem Hunt's still on the list to try to be the all-time leading rushing scorer in Rocket history. So we know what they're going to be able to do offensively. They have those weapons. They've been showing it, not just this year, but the last couple of years. Defensively, we've said many times, this is a team that wants to do some things defensively so they can get some accolades, so they can get some props. But they have some things to shore up. And, you know, I know a couple weeks ago they gave up the 55 to BYU, but that's BYU on the road. Very different from a home game, the whole rivalry week, against a BG team that is clearly struggling here in 2016. They got to shore up some things defensively.
offensively do the Rockets or Central Michigan is going to be able to do a lot more damage than what the Falcons did. And you heard Coach there. They do have an outstanding quarterback, so he's going to be able to make some things happen. If you're not short up defensively, if you're not hitting your assignments, then Central Michigan's going to absolutely be in this game all the way throughout and could steal it. So that's why, to me, the key in this game is a defensive response. Force some turnovers, get to the quarterback, just mess with their general game plan. The Rockets can do that, and it won't be a nail-biting game the way it was against Bowling Green back on Saturday. It's Central Michigan and the Toledo Rockets coming up at the Glass Bowl this Saturday. High noon, the kickoff for that one. And that's about going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza. Stick around. Mike Miller on Drive Time coming up next. We'll have more playoff baseball a little bit later on this evening. Game 4, Cubs Dodgers. Around 7, the coverage gets underway for that one. Could the Dodgers be going up 3-0 on the Cubs, letting all the panic of curses rearing their ugly heads once again? And we'll obviously talk recap of that and see if the Cleveland Indians can win a pennant, take 2 today in Toronto with their afternoon affair at the Rogers Center for Game 5. Series will shift back, if necessary, to Cleveland coming up on Friday. So you got all that. And we'll talk more about those things, of course, tomorrow, how it all shakes out. But stick around. Drive Time with Mike Miller next. And then a little bit later on this evening here on The Ticket, we'll get you some playoff baseball. So enjoy all of that. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.